This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Good.
Good. How are you?
Doing good. It's starting to turn a little colder
here. That's enough small talk.
I don't even want to hear about it's getting colder here in Florida.
No, he's in California.
Bad enough. I'm back in California.
Oh, you're back in California. Yeah. Oh, okay. So well, I was going to say it was bad enough when you were in California.
It's freezing here now.
But yeah, it's either 65. Way, just shut it. I don't want to hear it. Yeah. I've been seeing frost here. Farmer's Almanac says it's going to be a cold winter, too. So, you know, you got to get ready.
Yeah, how do you tell from the Farmer's Almanac?
They just know. they got old timer.
Like a Back to the Future.
Wisdom.
It's a Back to the Future thing, you know.
Yeah. Well, the guy next door.
You don't ask
is wearing
questions.
His red his red Pendleton. That tells the whole
exactly.
story.
Exactly. The day the Pendleton comes out, you know, how fuzzy the caterpillars are, how tall the beaver dam is. There are ways you can know.
That's fantastic. Oh my goodness. Well, how's the homestead doing? Have you planted some trees?
Yes, trees are getting planted. This is tree planting season. Mm-hmm. So you got two opportunities to plant trees every year. So mm-hmm. I'm going through another round and getting all kinds of stuff in. So none of the annuals are all going to sleep for the winter, but it's definitely time to get some trees in.
There you go.
Fall's better too because everything's on sale. So
Nathan, let me explain something to you. I know you're from Los Angeles. Now, what a tree is this kind of a plant.
And that's so you put it up during December and then you take it down in January.
That's good. That's it. That's about right. It's made the there's real ones as opposed to plastic. Come in a box.
I am seeing there's a lot of Christmas decorations starting to pop up around. We're not even to Halloween yet, and we're seeing lots of Christmas. In fact, lots of houses around here have both up, so they have like a Christmas wreath on their door, plus a lot of all the Halloween stuff out in the yard.
It's more
so
efficient.
I'm like, all right, you got to admire that. Yeah, it's like you're all in.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. That's good.
And they know it's going to be a cold, hard winter. Yeah, that's, so, you know, they're just trying to bring a little cheer.
Yeah, I mean, we go from a severe winter of illness and death to just a normal, cold, hard winter.
So. Winter of candy corn and Christmas cider.
Yep, that's good. Perfect.
Well, speaking of Halloween, I actually just have a random thought. Is if you had to dress up for Halloween, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, what would you dress up as?
Doesn't even occur. I don't even have a thought about it.
Like if Schwab came up to you with a gun.
Yeah,
and
I was
said,
thinking
you know,
about going, Schwab actually. Yeah. That's the first thing that came to mind.
Yeah. Klaus Schwab came up and says, "You have to dress up for Halloween."
Yeah,
I know. It's got to be some sort of globalist young leader, right? Like an up-and-coming globalist young leader. You could have all the trappings.
Wait, like, I all think the, it all should be little... Ted Kaczynski.
It's an excellent way to get on a lot of lists.
Oh man.
All right, I gotta hold on a second. Mo just barfed and he actually barfed on my cordless drill.
Oh. So, wow, okay. Well, give us a play by play.
Tool.
Well, his suffering seems to be uniquely timed to the podcast. I wonder if we've conditioned him over the years.
He's definitely, they're all conditioned to, as soon as I'm on the phone, especially if I'm on Zoom and I can't, Doug has the same experience with his cats. I've seen it happen.
Yeah, that's why they're just banned from the room. That's how it works.
They're non-human junior acquisition device, resource acquisition devices.
Exactly what they are.
They are. J-Rads. Yeah, scratching at the door and breaking into the food. And Melly broke into the food today. In fact, I put like an eye hook on the closet door to keep her out, and she got in anyway.
Oh, man. So
she's very resourceful.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, Nathan.
Onward.
All right. You like that, Dr. Lyle? I remembered one of your acronyms. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you did. I'm really happy about that.
That's good. Oh, that's good. Yeah.
All right.
You get the Larry Star of Valor.
Yeah.
I get a little gold star.
You do.
Oh, my goodness. All right, Nathan, what do we got?
All right. Dear doctors, how well does clinical evolutionary psychology explain and treat behavioral problems of children, like aggression or violence, maybe even even towards their own parents who have a reliable history of being loving and warm and not abusive? Do you have any recommendations for literature, reading sources, or books on psychology for people interested in dealing with aggressive kids?
Well, here's what I am always thinking. Okay, so we're thinking that the child is nothing other than a JRAD. It's a junior resource acquisition device, just to remind everybody of that term. Okay. And so what it's attempting to do when it's being aggressive is the aggression is generally secondary to irritation or anger. In other words, those are the same thing, just on a dimension of feeling like it's being treated unfairly, and now it's going to use some kind of forceful action in order to get the resource that it wants. So all creatures are always running cost-benefit analyses on whatever plan they have to acquire resources. And so an aggressive child is is just a disagreeable or low conscientious or emotionally unstable creature. That's just what it is. And so or it could be, i.e. habitually aggressive child. So the roots of that are going to be in both its potentially youth and inability to, in other words, it's not going to be very stable. It's not going to have a lot of stress tolerance, etc. And so it may become quite a bit better creature as it ages, and its brain gets bigger and it can calculate long-term cost-benefit analyses and impact on relationships and grudges that people will hold against you, et cetera, et cetera. So it could become better, or it could become worse, or it could be about the same. We're not sure what we're looking at when it comes to that individual's characteristics. But one thing we know for sure is that we're not changing it. So that child's genetics are that child's genetics. So so when they say, quote, what do we say about explain and treat, okay, treat, that's this person's using common terminology that makes perfect sense to, the medical industrial complex. But the truth of the matter is we manage a conflict of interest between that child and its environment, including us. There's no, quote, treatment because we're not fixing it. Okay? See, so, in other words, this behavior is emanating out of that child's genetics. And so, so we're not going to fix it. What we're going to do is we're going to manage it, and we're going to manage it the way we would manage any relationship and conflicts, which is through cost-benefit analysis and the alteration of the environment that it finds itself in. So if I have an aggressive child that's beating up on its younger brother, for example, or getting aggressive with me or destroying things or anything else, if I can't ship it off to boarding school because I can't afford it, what I'm going to do is I'm going to impose penalties that will be reasonable. In other words, they need to fit the crime so that you don't feel vindictive and angry when you are imposing it. You are essentially like you're just like an administrator. Like, this is the rules, you do that's what's gonna happen to you. Simple, okay? and you are as immediate and ruthless, and you don't let them talk you out of the penalty. And this is, we try to figure out what penalties, you know, where do we have leverage over the kid? So we may give the kid something so that it wants something a lot so that we can take it away. Okay, so maybe it loves an iPad. Great. Okay. If you're like, oh my God, my kid loves its iPad, it's going to destroy its brain from staring at it all day long. Hey, if it's an aggressive kid, let it stare at it all day long. We don't care. It's not destroying its brain, just distracting it and you know, causing those eyeballs to follow the little things around. Now, that's a good thing, because if it gets aggressive with its peers or you or anybody else, then what we're going to do is we're going to pull it away. Okay, that gives us leverage. So, i.e., if in an older child, it would be, hey, no car keys for you, if that's what goes down. So, you know, or a cell phone for some kid, it'd be like, oh, we got control over that thing. So you want to have resources that you can pull away from them, and you hang those over their head like a sword of Damocles, so that they get one inch out of line and they lose a resource. Now, the reason why you want to, the punishment fits the crime, because if you use the death penalty, like, well, if you do that, then you're going to lose your rights to that thing for a month. It doesn't do any good. Okay. You want to be smart about what the penalty is. It's like they lose it for 24 hours and you follow through perfectly. Okay. And they suffer those 24 hours looking at the clock, trying to renegotiate. In other words, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, nope, sorry. I don't, you know, your father and I make the rules. So it's not a singular thing. And so my job, I just enforce them. That's it. Or Dr. Schmo that wrote the book on this makes the rules. I'm just here to enforce them. So we enforce them. And so then finally they get out of the trap. In other words, they pay their penalty. Now it's right back over their head again. Okay. So that's how we, quote, treat aggressive children, is we find things that they want, that we give them, resources that are important to them, and we yank them right out from under them when they get out of line. That's the only way that I can imagine that this could be managed. This is precisely how we manage the most aggressive people in the world. It's called a maximum security prison. You would be surprised at how civil it is in a maximum security prison. If you were there, you'd have people walking around with the most outrageous looking tattoos all over their faces and their skulls that you ever saw. Loaded with testosterone, muscles bulging out, they're snarling at everybody just when they're trying to smile. But the truth is that they're quite civil. And the reason is, if they get out of line, they're in trouble. Okay, so you'd be surprised at how frustrated they can get and how threatening they can get, but they choose their words very carefully, because if they get just one inch over a line, then they're going to lose all their crap. They're going to be rolled up. All their stuff's going to be in the storage where it gets stolen. And then they're going to be in solitary for 60 days. And, you know, they lost everything. And that's how it happens. Their $128 TV set that their family saved up to buy for them mysteriously disappears and is lost in property. That's just absolutely routine. And everybody knows it. So remarkably, 4,000 felons can actually get along surprisingly well. So we can do the same basic concept with a pain in the ass 7-year-old. They're not as stable as the felons, but they respond to the same types of contingencies. Find what they want, or if you need to, give it to them to discover what it is that they want, and then pull it out from under them with reasonable penalties fitting the crime, so that when you impose the penalty, they don't have this, well, I've just been given the death penalty. I'm not going to have it for a month anyway, so what do I give a shit? Now I'm going to act out and be a complete and total pain in the ass in protest. Okay? So we don't do that. We have the penalty fit beautifully to the crime so that they can barely stand it. It might be, you know, 3 hours you don't get your computer or your cell phone. That might be the right thing to do. And ooh, boy, that turns out that's enough to have them, you know, worry about whether or not they should shove their little brother. So that's how we do it.
Fascinating.
That all make sense, Jen?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about this. I think that you are dealing in many cases with little miniature felons.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things I hear, we get this aversion of a question all the time, which is, well, if personality is stable and personality can't change, then why is my personality different in this context than it is in that context? Or another version of it is, why is my kid such a shithead when he comes home from my ex-husband's house? And when he's here, he's totally polite and everything's fine. But when he comes back after staying over there for a weekend or a week, he's completely out of control and has all these bad behaviors. And so you're observing that there's, in addition to being little junior resource acquisition devices, they are also boundary testing constantly, like felons would, to see exactly what they can get away with in this environment. And so expectations are important. And I think just reading into the tea leaves of the question, this kind of, you say there's parents who have a history of being loving and warm and not abusive. I'm not saying you should be, you know, spanking the kid or engaging in corporal punishment in any way, but the kind of disciplinary environment is probably pretty permissive, just generally. And so I think there's going to be employing these techniques that Doug is talking about in a very consistent way over time that just resets the whole expectations of you know, what does it mean to be a kid in this household? Like, what can I get away with, and what's reasonable? So you're not going to change the personality. You're going to see behavioral change that moves in concert with environmental change that is consistent and therefore informs the sort of a stable cost benefit analysis of that little brain about, you know, what's possible, what's the most I can get for the least amount of effort. And that can look like a effective, quote unquote, therapeutic intervention or a major behavioral change. But it's really, you're just resetting the environment, and you can do it in these kind of specific doses, like you're describing, in combination with just hey, it's new sheriff in town.
Right.
You know, like I think we sort of had a little miscommunication about what it means to live in this household and live under this roof. Depends on the age of the kid. I mean, if you're dealing with a 7-year-old, it's a little different than a 13-year-old. Mm-hmm. But a 13-year-old, you can say, these are the expectations. This is how it's going to be. And I think politically, from an politically incorrect perspective, too, a lot of this is the job of dads, frankly. It's the job of the masculine role in the family unit. And I'm just inferring that if we're talking about an aggressive kid, we're probably talking about a son, probably talking about a boy. And so I don't think it is natural to many maternal nervous systems to be the master disciplinarian in the home. And I think the kind of set of expectations that little boy is that would optimize the environment for that little boy includes a pretty stern dad with pretty strong expectations of what's okay and what's not okay.
I can't help but infer.
Well said.
Yeah, I can't help but infer that shifts the cost benefit if there's a male figure there, of just the subtle threat of violence that if you get so out of line.
Sure, it's physically dangerous. Yeah, mom's not going to hurt you. Yeah.
Without a doubt. I had an interesting thing. I had someone write to me about their 20-something son who's unstable and in an addiction thing. And then the son was wanting super fancy rehab treatment. And so the individual's writing to me, what do I think?
Sounds like a vacation. Sounds like a paid vacation.
This is what I said, and I didn't hear back. I said, well, a mattress on the floor in the garage and, you know, a space heater and blankets so they're not going to be cold. And, you know, hopefully there's a sink with hot water so they can give themselves a little bird bath. And certainly a loaf of bread and a jar of peanut butter and an apple every day outside the door. That's it. So those are circumstances that are vastly better.
And a lock on the door.
Yeah. In other words, those are vastly better circumstances than how most humans in the world live today. Most humans in the world don't have a comfortable, spacious shelter.
They don't have access to clean water. They don't have a steady, consistent food supply that's perfectly nutritious and fine. They don't have a safe, comfortable place to sleep. These are excellent environmental circumstances. Now, what that person's going to be under is deprivation of what it is that they could have in life that would be available if they strung together consistently, you know, regulated behavior in search of a goal. That's a good thing that they've got deprivation. In the same way that, you know, we with a 7-year-old, 9-year-old, pain in the ass kid, 16-year-old kid that wants the car and he's just so upset that it's being taken away. Deprivation is a fine thing for human beings to experience. They may not like it, but it's perfectly healthy for them. And the most fundamentally, you know, poverty and hunger, these are the things that motivate all animals to hustle to try to get good ecological circumstances and plenty of food and water. And so if we take those incentives away, we're likely to get, you know, behavior that gets loose around the edges and starts getting a little bit antisocial, because if I don't have to be carefully regulated in my behavior, then I won't be. Okay? But if I have to be, then I will be. And so that's how that goes. That's how, like I said, the prisoners in a maximum security prison are spectacularly well behaved. I mean, they're better behaved than they ever were in their lives. Mm-hmm. Okay. And very often they go through an adjustment period for a while where the same tantrums and anger and fist fights and everything else that, you know, was characteristic of them settle down after a couple, 3 months. They realize it's not working, that they're running up against a concrete wall. And of course, that's, you know, my attitude towards, you know, difficult children that are going through addictive, unstable processes is, we're not being mean and vindictive and angry, and we're not scolding and we're not shaming. We're just explaining, this is safe and comfortable and you're completely safe here. You're not going to starve. I don't want people in trouble physically. I don't want them desperate and clawing and anything else. I want them comfortable, but I want them deprived. Okay. I want them to have incentive to, you know, now you're laying in that bed. You haven't had anything to drink or haven't had any heroin. Why? Because you don't have any money. Because I didn't give it to you. Okay. And if they say, well, gee, I need a haircut if I'm going to get a job. Good. I'll go down with you to Supercuts and I'll sit right there and you'll get your haircut and then I'll pay the $10. I'm not giving you the $10. No way. Okay. So that's, we can direct more resources to people if they need them, but we're never giving them a dollar, not a chance. If they're going to get a dollar, they're going to have to go chisel it out of the free market somewhere through effective action. Okay. So anyway, I think that the person that wrote to me was definitely a mom. And I think that the reason why I'm reminded of this is Jen's talking about the masculine versus feminine energy on this dimension. Like, I'm perfectly willing to watch children suffer. Doesn't bother me at all. Okay.
I can just hear that getting taken out of context.
We'll take a quote, put on a shirt, sweatshirt somewhere. Comfortable, exactly. But deprived.
I'm perfectly fine having all kinds of people suffer if it's consistent with what's in their best interest.
Suffer relative to their current state of animal in a zoo.
Yes.
Abundance that is.
And when they deprive animals in the zoo, they actually get happier.
Of course, yes. Of course. And we talked about that many times in the context of that problem. But the other kind of half of that, yeah, of, you know, the mattress in the basement scenario, yeah, is that, you know, the awareness that passage is rehab in Malibu or wherever the kid wants to go, mm-hmm, for $1,000 a day is not going to, it's not going to do shit. It's going to be worse than useless, mm-hmm, in almost every case. I mean, interventional substance abuse rehab is a total racket and is, it's just as it's likely to be just about as productive as most therapeutic interventions,
right,
most psychodynamic therapy that you're going,
except
to go to.
Way
and it's
more
firmly
expensive.
Rooted, way more expensive. Sure. And it's very rooted in, mm-hmm, you know, let's process our issues and our traumas, mm-hmm, and confront our family dynamics and all of this kind of stuff. And it's not that can't be useful to do some of that. But the idea that if you're going to go check yourself in for 28 days and pay $50,000 and you're going to be, you know, cleared of this issue because you've punched a pillow a few times and you've yelled at your dad, like, it's just, it's not going to, it's really not how it works. So I think, you know, it's not that the basement model is in principle any better, but it's certainly not worse as far as getting sober long term.
Yeah.
The closest I will come when I'm talking to parents like this, and I get this similar question a lot, is depending on the situation and depending on the kid, I think spending some money on something like one of the quote unquote troubled kid outward bound type programs might make sense, because you're essentially spending money to put the kid in a pretty significant state of deprivation.
Yes.
To go out there, and a couple of things happen there with a program like that. They are you know, going to have mentors. They're going to have young male mentors that they are in a position that they want to look up to and impress and gain esteem from. Mm-hmm. They're going to build a self-esteem process by learning to trust themselves and have pride in what they're able to do physically out in a sort of a scary world where they have to make a campfire and pitch a tent and stare down cougars. And they're going to be just in an uncomfortable situation where they kind of have to fend for themselves and learn new skills and deal with it in a way that they typically are not accustomed to. So I think a good program like that, and I'm not really in a position, I mentioned Outward Bound because it's the one that comes to mind that I'm most familiar with, but I don't actually know much about the program enough to recommend or not recommend it. Mm-hmm. But I would advise people to kind of look into those things. Mm-hmm. And I know that programs like that do have special, special courses for kids within certain age groups that are dealing with substance abuse, for example. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, third party anecdotal stories that they've been helpful mm-hmm. in some cases. So I would do that before dropping a bunch of money on a conventional rehab situation.
Not even close. I would completely agree with you. So the, I don't know of such a thing. And again, they're probably pretty pricey. So
very pricey.
Yeah, my first stop is, you know, the garage.
The basement.
Cheapest version first.
I think that's The garage with you know, maybe a friend, like a sobriety coach type sponsor type person who can be in a position to sharp angle.
Yes. Right.
You know, I read a glorious example of sharp angling. I was going to send it to you, Doug. I was rereading a passage from Grapes of Wrath. It's been years and years since I read it, and I was reading it in context of something else. And they're, of course, on their trip, and they need a part for their car. And so they stop at a junkyard to get this part. I don't know if you remember the scene or anything about it, but they run into this one-eyed man, this man who lost his eye. We don't get to hear how he lost his eye, but he's not even wearing a patch. It's like the description is the muscles are squirming when he blinks, and he's greasy and he's gross, and the guy's just self-pitying beyond, you know, like, oh, poor me, and nobody wants me because I don't have an eye, and I hate my boss, and I haven't been on a date since I lost my eye, and everything sucks and it's terrible. And Tom says at some point in disgust, listen to you. You like it. You like feeling all sorry for yourself. You know what? I knew a one-legged whore once and she charged extra. It's an amazing passage because it's just really kind of taking this guy and being like, oh my God, you're getting secondary gain from all of the self-pitying going on. Mm-hmm. And there's no in principle reason that you couldn't go out there and get a job and be competitive and do your best like everybody else. You know, take what's happened to you and turn it around. It's all up to you. So to have somebody like that, you know, some sort of one-legged horror mentor who's like able to kind of come to the garage and just talk tough to this kid.
Yeah.
Just be like, get over yourself. You are not that special. The kind of talk you're going to get in a good AA meeting. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you think you've got it hard? Like, let me tell you some stories about what I've been through. Yeah. And it, just to give him perspective. Mm-hmm. And so he's not totally on his own trying to figure it out.
Wonderful. Is a good time to tell our listeners that another way you can hear more about this is through the Living Wisdom Library. So if you guys go to, if those of you who have not actually become members, the members who do know, they know what sharp angling is because you guys have talked about it. But if you go to esteemdynamics.com and become a member there, that's a really, really good use of your time. But for people who don't know what sharp angling is, can you go over that briefly, Dr. Lau, Dr. Hawk?
Yeah. It's my term for a clinical technique that I invented. I didn't actually really quite understand it until Jen started explaining the facts of life to me about trauma mongering. And that is that it was my response, very a right-brained kind of thing, where when people would start to whine and complain about a situation, I would immediately, I would come at them from an angle that they didn't see coming. It's fundamentally what people are doing when they're whining and complaining is that they are attempting to get resources. They're attempting to marshal resources and support from a position where, quote, they've been treated so unfairly. And the response, you know, what I will occasionally do, I'll do it more consciously now, but in the old days, it was an unconscious thing where I'm computing effectively that your circumstances are well within the bell curve of what is fair. And so you whining about it being unfair is ridiculous. And so I'm going to immediately reject the entire premise, okay? And so the sharp angle was, no, don't even start with that, okay? And I reject your premise outright. It's the equivalent of taking being an insurance adjuster and taking out a big stamp, and as soon as they start talking, just stamp right on their thing, claim denied. They're like, no, you're not getting anything.
Yeah, you're not going to get anywhere with me with that strategy.
Right.
I'm not your mommy.
That's right.
I don't feel sorry for you.
It's very different between mom and dad. And
yeah.
I can remember, as Jen and I talked this through a few years ago, when Jen was starting to see clients instead of astrologically, she was starting to see them like real life, legitimate, you know what I mean, trying to non-mysteriously.
I still see them astrologically. It's a different kind of vision. You wouldn't understand.
I wouldn't understand. Exactly. I wouldn't understand.
I had mom problems.
Yeah. So we recognized that this was, Jen was actually kind of having a hard time, with it because she could see the logic to it, but it didn't feel right. It didn't feel right because you're way more mom than you are dad.
Yeah.
And
I've gotten more disagreeable with time. All of my clients are listening right now, like, she doesn't seem to have that hard a time with
it. Yeah, we're sort of molding together into one person slowly.
It's true. It's true. We're both. Well, yeah, because you kind of see the patterns. And
yes.
You know where it's going.
Right.
I extend less rope to somebody now, and I see that it's it's the one-eyed man. It's the one-eyed man complaining about how woe is me, and I'll let you sing your song for a while, but
right.
If I see that it's not appropriate, if it's not as you're saying, obviously people have all kinds of terrible circumstances, and you and I are both very, very empathetic when appropriate.
Yes.
But if it's a tale of self-pitying woe that mm-hmm. is not appropriate for an insurance claim, we will deny it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, helpful for people. I know it's helpful for people, and I think often it is appreciated by people even in the moment.
Yes, amazingly so.
And it is in the story. It is for the one-eyed man in the story. He actually, he says, you think I could get a job? It's a very classic. It's right out of something we would write. And really, you think I could do that? It's this moment where he's kind of dragged out of this self-imposed pity and ego trap. And he gets a glimpse of the capacity that he has to be competitive in the world.
Not unlike what the day that I discovered the ego trap. Mm-hmm.
It reminded me very much of that guy. Yeah. The tone that he takes in the story is exactly the same.
Yes.
Amazing.
Fantastic. Yeah. Wonderful. All right, Nathan, what else we got?
Yeah. All right. So our next question, dear doctors, I have been told often that men retreat from their romantic partner emotionally when they are upset. Is that a gender difference in coping mechanisms, or is it just that men are inherently less invested in relationships than women?
Is this they're retreating from the partner when the male is upset, or they're retreating from the upset woman? it's a different scenario.
Yeah, it turns out that what they're referring to is research that was done by John Gottman. And so this is a famous piece of literature in man-woman dynamics and psychotherapy, because very little of that research has actually ever been done. But Gottman was legitimate. And in apparently in his group where he was studying sort of naturalistically the conflicts, you know, and recording them, they watched carefully and they saw that in 36 clients, in 36 out of 36 times, the pattern was exactly the same. That as things escalated, the guys retreated. And Gottman was interested in this, and he, as the women were getting more shrill, Gottman actually had, I think, some simple physiological measures like a plethysmograph, you know, on the fingers, or I don't know what he did, but what he found is that the men were actually highly aroused, much more than the women, apparently, is according to my memory. We're going back a long time for me, but this is my memory of this. And the notion was, or the inference that was being made was, the men are getting the hell away from the women because they might be unconsciously fearing that they're gonna get violent. That the men will get violent, okay? Mm. So it's basically like, you know what? You're upset, you're pissing me off, and probably a good move is for me to get some space between me and you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Women, I think it can be very frustrating for men that...
there's a certain chuckle.
The truth is that
it's a dangerous chuckle.
Women are inherently more verbally facile than men. And when you get into an argument with a woman that's got a good, you know, intellectual and verbal motor, they can start to run circles around you. And you can feel like you're getting,
even the score with the muscles.
Floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee. You know what I mean? You can't hit it. And so that's, I think you'll see the potential for men essentially getting run around the block and can't keep up and trying to defend themselves, trying to make their point, and the women sort of racing ahead with, 5% more verbal capability. And that's enough to, now you blow your stack. Okay. And so you essentially, the underlying potential dynamic of the man being bigger and stronger, deeper voice, more testosterone, and fundamentally more physically dangerous, that now enters the game if you're sufficiently upset. And so that, hell, I've seen that right in my psychotherapy office. And so so I think that that's in the equation. And I think that Gottman's inferences there may be true. You know, and I could see how that could be, essentially an evolutionarily adaptive strategy where you're feeling like, screw it. You know what I mean? this is, I've got to override, you know, I've got competing agendas here, but one of them, it might be a good idea to just get some space. And, you know, that all that that would have to be would be that that would be sort of evolutionarily more effective under certain contexts. Now, maybe it's just in the Gottman context where you're under study. In other words, so there's a third party watching, et cetera. But just the idea that there would be, you know, an agenda of let me back away from this conflict, and that that would be a more male tendency wouldn't surprise me at all if what's been observed there might have evolutionary roots.
Well, especially if he's inferring that he's losing the fight in right. front of everybody.
Right.
So if everybody's watching and gathered around and eating their caveman popcorn
right.
and he's losing,
right.
You know, his choices are to get violent or
right.
to retreat.
Right.
And getting violent is not going to be the right choice a lot of the time because it's going
right.
to bring down his status among the men in the village, et cetera. So,
yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, from that context, it makes perfect sense that that men, I've observed that too, that, you know, if it does kind of in an active hot conflict situation, he is more likely to retreat.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I don't think that's a one-off with Gottman. I was sort of reading the question a little potentially differently, which is if he's got issues, mm-hmm. if they both have issues that they're upset about, she's more likely to verbalize them and bring them to him, and he's more likely to retreat and pretend everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That was what I thought was being asked, which mm-hmm. I wonder if there's truth to that beyond personality difference that maps onto gender. I'm not sure that would be true.
I would have to agree with you. We would, that seems much sketchier and uncertain.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that
if you're a more aggressive person, male or female,
right.
more just, yeah, there's a lot of personality factors
yes.
that would drive that. But
I think
women are just as likely to be in retreat in that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Yeah.
All right, Nathan, what else we got?
Dear doctors, what impact has women's education and empowerment had on gender dynamics?
Good. Shut it down.
This is a couple part question. So the second part is, if left
right.
to our primal instincts, hypothetically, if in a place where humans are born and there is no culture to begin with, I'm not sure what that means, would men be inseminating attractive women left, right, and center forcibly by overpowering them? Or is there now a genetic component for mutual consent seeking?
Oh, yeah, that's not hard. So the first issue about, quote, what was it, empowerment and what?
Female empowerment on gender dynamics.
Oh, I mean, there'd be a lot of different ways to look at that. What exactly do we mean by empowerment?
Well, and what exactly do you mean by gender dynamics? So, yeah, we got to define your terms because
yeah.
If we say has the fact that women are now in the workplace had an effect on the way men and women court each other, like absolutely, right? Like there's sort of women having more equal status relative to men in the workplace and just relatively across the board
mm-hmm.
has influenced dating. And we've talked about that before, but
mm-hmm.
gender dynamics, like within a pair bond, for example, there's a lot of different directions that we could go here.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to say about that. The women's empowerment, that a fundamental source of the empowerment would be bigger income. And bigger incomes are definitely going to impact all of these relationships are sitting, what they are is they're very complicated multidimensional trades. And so therefore, you know, what you have to offer and what it is that you need is going to make a big, you know, your context is going to make a big difference. So a woman that has money behind her and she has high income and it's steady, et cetera, that it is enough for her personal desires with respect to her, you know, consumptive patterns. So it might be $50,000 a year is plenty, or it might be $150,000 a year is plenty. But whatever it is, an individual that feels in a position of power with respect to that is in a different position than someone who isn't. And so as a result of that, the more of a position of power that you're in, the greater and greater weight you're going to give towards selecting males for how sexy you feel like they are, as opposed to how good they would be as providers. Okay, to the extent that those two things they could be interrelated and correlated, but they can also be completely unrelated and uncorrelated. So therefore, we would expect that those women's quote empowerment in the financial arena would have a very substantial impact on mating choice, as every old geezer that ever headed to Thailand could tell you.
Which city specifically?
90 Day Fiancé is my favorite
what is it?
Documentation. You know, there's always a reality TV show for every evolutionary psychology dynamic. And right. So 90 Day Fiancé is my favorite to illustrate that in action, where you got lots of old geezers heading to Thailand or the Philippines or Brazil.
I want to watch that show. I can learn something.
What cities are these
specifically, just so we know not to go there?
Oh my God.
That's great, Nathan. That's just beautiful.
Don't be gross. That's another t-shirt for the store.
Don't be gross, says the one-eyed whore or something, whatever it was.
It's one-legged whore. One-eyed man. Get it right.
It's really good. All right. What was the second part of that?
If left to our primal instincts, where there's no culture to begin with, would men just be forcibly overpowering, you know, adolescent fertile girls, or is there a genetic component of mutual consent seeking?
Well, with no culture, you're saying there's no, I mean, that's basically, there's no other people around, right? This is a political science kind of bugaboo to talk about what is culture, what do we mean by culture? So I don't think you can say you're in a culture-free context unless if there are other humans with social expectations of what constitutes reasonable behavior or in a position to allocate resources non-randomly, that's culture, right? Because you got to sing for your supper one way or another. So I think you can't divorce if you were the only primate on earth and there's another female primate on earth, I think the consent relationship is probably going to be a little different than if you're embedded in any kind of social context. So Doug was going to get started on this as well, but that would be my take on that.
Totally. There's no, in other words, you're never mating isolated out from a tribe.
In a vacuum. No.
Yeah. And so
there's no such thing. It's one of these thought experiments that has no basis in reality.
Meaning.
So it's,
So the male knows that he is recognizable as an individual and that he's very recognizable as an individual because there's not very many other people. And that it would be unusual for him to trap a female out in isolation by herself and then force his way to the eggs. And if he does this, he's going to be remembered, okay? And then, therefore, she's likely to have brothers, you know, uncles, cousins, and possibly, obviously, a mate. And that this guy is basically just done a life-threatening act. Okay, so he's very likely to be killed. So that is this gets to be this huge gray area of what was a rape? Did you know him? Did you come on to him? And if he's the biggest, toughest guy in the village and you flirted with him a little bit, but then you were saying no, and then it's like, well, you know, nobody's going to knock him over the head if that happens once in a while. If it starts happening with some consistency to other guys' mates and there's some really serious grumbling and a complaint, then the males will quietly get together and they will kill him. Okay? So the extraordinary thing that you don't see in other animals is you don't see basically the coordination
of multiple males against one aggressive male. This is not something, the elephant seals, they don't conspire two or three of them to take on alpha all at the same time and take him down. That's not how they're built genetically. They're built for those brutal contests in a you know, vertical hierarchy. Humans don't do it that way. So humans are really fancy and sophisticated, and they've figured out how three of us weaklings can take on the big guy and kill the son of a bitch. So the big guy, when you happen to have genes that are located in a big, strong body with a lot of testosterone, you also have neural circuits that were built alongside those other males in evolution, where you also know that you better not be using that big strength and aggression too aggressively, or else they will do what? Gang up and kill you. You better be reasonably civil and pleasant and, quote, obey the genetically built-in culture. So that's how we would look at it. That's exactly what Jen was talking about. It's you are a political animal, and you are built that way by nature. So it doesn't mean that those thoughts and feelings, that you don't have opportunistic rapists sitting inside of male psychologies to some degree. In other words, all things being under the perfect set of circumstances, you know, would I do this? The male brain should be built under certain conditions to consider that. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we've broken through, you know, the wall of Athens. Okay. And now we've got a whole group of guys. And as far as we're concerned, we butcher the men and we rape the women, and it's totally freaking fair. Okay. That, in other words, I'm not going to be under censure by the other males to be raping the Athenian women. Okay. It's every man for himself now that we're in here. So you can see that's probably where a huge percentage of rapes have taken place, is exactly in tribal warfare, where there's been a rout of the other males, and now that the males will behave that way. So but anyway, those are quite unusual, specialized circumstances where that would happen, but never would we see this. The vast majority of all human beings that have ever been conceived have been conceived under consensual situations, because the most stable
consensual-ish.
Consensual-ish. Right.
Just like, I mean, this, the essay that people should read if they're interested in this is Richard Wrangham's essay on, mm-hmm. on conspiratorial violence among men in human groups. And I think he calls it groupishness. This is mm-hmm. the evolution of human groupishness. Mm-hmm. And so I would extend that to say that the consent within the group is consent-ish. This is not full enthusiastic consent as we would define it in the modern world.
Right. That makes a lot perfect sense. So the person's suspicion that it could be a lot nastier is accurate, and it's going to turn out that this has been a sort of a evolutionary check and balance process, and that's how it would have been.
Yeah, yep. that's the other piece of that hypothesis, is that it's actually a key piece of language development among humans, the sort of conspiring to mm-hmm. take out the worst men of the village among the other men.
Yeah.
Because this is such a uniquely human characteristic. So it's an important part of our ability to communicate, and how we develop that was to conspire with each other to basically enforce the culture, quote unquote, of the village, of the community.
Right. Absolutely. I.e. that big son of a bitch is more cost than he is benefit.
Yeah. Take him out.
And we all agree. Okay.
Yep. Yeah.
So therefore, you know, what is moral is what it is that we all feel like is in fundamentally the, quote, group's best interest.
Mm.
And that's the evolution of moral sentiments. And so group versus individual, that guy's seeking his individual interests at the expense of the group. And our communications with him that he's doing that have met on sociopathic deaf ears. So now he's a dead man. That is exactly how that would have played out.
Is this also the function of gossip as well, as to kind of gently figure out who's doing what and what boundaries they may be crossing?
Gossip serves many purposes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gossip is so useful in so many ways. So, mm-hmm. yeah, that's one of the ways that it's useful. But it's useful for improving resource acquisition. It's important for building trust. It's important for projecting into the future how people are going to align themselves. It's, mm-hmm. I mean, it just has 1,000 uses. So, yeah, that's a whole other conversation.
Displaying your own status, all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, show off. Yep. Yeah,
yep. All kinds of stuff. All right. Well,
get information, find out if that other girl mm-hmm. likes you, et cetera. So,
yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Unbelievably useful. Anybody says don't gossip, they have no idea what they're talking about. Jen and I gossip all the time.
mostly about Larry.
Yeah, mostly about Larry. You got it. Oh, my goodness. All right. I think it's probably good, Nathan.
All right. Yeah. Well, our next question had to do with similar things. So we can go over it next time, but it's about, you know, what you talked about in the previous question about women making more money and, you know, maybe changing up a little bit. But Dr. Hawk.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, yeah, we got to get Jen, you know, indoors. I mean, we got to get her turning on the heater because it's freezing cold there in Virginia because winter's here.
It's true. It is a little chilly.
You got to sew up your wool socks, Jen.
That's not very vegan, Doug.
Oh, sorry about that. I didn't know that. Oh, God. Okay, sorry.
My
about
organic
that.
Cotton socks.
That's
okay?
it. That's it. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
All right. Well.
All right.
Dr. Hawk, right, Dr. Lyle, and hopefully Mo feels a little bit better after this. Thank you so much for. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us today and for wonderful questions. We'll look forward to talking to you guys next week.
All right.
Awesome.
All good, Nathan. I'll see you soon, everybody.
All right.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.